Now they quote another pasuk. It says, "Before you say more, if you wish, you can interpret it from this. It's written to Sheiyo Yukashar. Literally, it means, and destruction will beat down a gate. But that's not the way it's going to be interpreted. Okay? How is it going to be interpreted? So the answer is, let's take a look at the Rashi. Okay? Sheiyo. You see where it says Gemara in the Rashi? Go down a few lines over there. And in the middle line, says Sheir, says Russian base bias, Ashawame Yoshe. Says the language is that of a pasuk which says that the house becomes bare without anybody living over there, right? Becomes waste without anybody living over there. And as a result of that, who runs to occupy the space over there? He says, Seir Miraktim Shal. Now, Seir in Hebrew, in this case, has two different meanings. The normal meaning of the word Seir is a young goat. Okay? Seir Zim Echot, Chatos, etc., etc., right? That's a young goat, a young kid. But, well, it's a kid. It's a goat. Okay? But at any rate, Seir is also found in Yeshayahu, for example, in the sense of like a satyr, S-A-T-Y-R, in the sense like, you know, like goat-like evil spirits or something
devil,
like that.
Yeah.
Right. So that this is what the translation is over here. This is how they understood it. And the Tokach Seir Miraktim Shav, because, you know, the population is gone, so the Seirim, the satyrs, they have a good time dancing over there, right? And what do? They thrust against and they knock down the gates of the house, okay? So in other words, destruction follows because there's no human around anymore, you know, to take care of the house, okay? Reminds me of some houses also, you know, like in Holyoke. Well, Leolenu, you know, houses become alive. I've seen it in Springfield too, houses. I've seen it in the Bronx. I remember you used to go down the East Bronx, give all the Koyshek over there when you see all the houses that were ruined over there. Houses that at one time they housed the population that was alive and living over there. And then, yeah, so you have the Seirim coming in over there instead. Okay? Sheia Yukashar. So he takes it in the sense that Sheia is the same as Seir. In other words, the satyrs knock down the gates. And Omamar Ravashi, he says, Lididi Chazili, he says, I saw it actually with my own eyes. And you know what? Umenagach Kitora, he was banging against it like a bull. In other words, you know, as a bull comes and he gores and so on, right?
He
so
gored like a ox.
Right. So this is what he was doing, okay? Omer Rav Huna said, Zimra de Nagde ud Bakore Shari, says, the song of Nagde. Nagde are sailors, says Rashi. Okay? But not only that, it's not really sailors, he says, but he says these are the people, according to Rashi, who pull the boat along by ropes. I mean, it reminds me, you know, the Volga boatmen, you know.
Yeah.
For example, Erie Canal and so on, they also used to have human mules, or they had human beings, you know, to pull, right? So he says, when you have men who are singing and pulling the ropes, that is permitted. Why? Because they need it in order to sustain the rhythm of work. So that's okay. Likewise, the Bakari are people who are using animals, that they're using oxen in the field in order to plow. Because according to Rashi, the oxen respond to the melody of the plowman. So it was necessary for work. If it's necessary for work, then in that case, such music, such singing is permissible. But the Gardai Asir, if it's weavers who are singing, it's prohibited. Why? Because they don't need it. They're only singing in order to amuse themselves. They don't need it in order to improve the quality of their work. No, Rav Huna Bat Yil Zimra. Here's a maisa. Rav Huna, he said, from now on, all music is prohibited. Okay? And you know what the result was? Kom mea boze v'zuzo. As a result, 100 geese could be bought for one zuz, right? Let's say for a quarter, right? Umeya saw chite v'zuzo. And also, you could buy 100 measures of wheat also for a zuz. In other words, the reward for abolishing music was the fact that food became so plentiful, you know, because people, were paying attention to agriculture and everything else, and they didn't waste their money on song and music and so on. But what happened?
How did it help the farmer?
That's a good question. Yeah. And not only that, but I left out the last two words. It says, "Velo iboy," which means, and there wasn't even a demand because it was so plentiful that people couldn't buy everything that was available. Okay, so also Rav Chisda, came along, Zilzobei, and he made fun of this edict of Rav Huna, right? And he said, "Ah, not so gefellig. You're permitted to say." So what happened? Then in that particular case, Yiboy Avzo Bezuzo, to try to find even one goose that would be purchased for a zuz, Velomish Takaf, and that could not be found. In other words, the price went up tremendously, so you could no longer buy a goose for that figure, right? And as a result, the great plenty of food, that they had, that disappeared. And people just didn't have enough money to buy it because he did away with the edict against music. Omar Rabbi Yosef, added the following concerning song. He says, Zamre Gavre Vione Noshe Prisusa. He says, if men sing and then the women respond to the men's song, so this leads to pritzus. In other words, it's not nice, okay? It's like a step towards immorality, okay? Zamre noshe, but if women sing the onigavri and the men respond to them, then he says that's ke'esh bin ores. It's like fire in flax, in other words, it means that it inflames the passions so tremendously that it's even worse than the other one. Naoret means literally it's the waste product when you beat out flax to make linen. So l'may nafkamina. So the question is: so what is the difference between one form and the other form? So it says that it's tulei hot mekameha. It says, if you can't do away with both of them, then in any case, the second one is worse than the first one, and that you should try to get rid of at least the second one. In other words, the women singing and the men responding. Okay. All right. Omar Rabbi Yochanan said as follows. It's called Hashosa V'Arbo Minei Zemer Mevi Chamesh Bon Tzuyilam. He bases this now upon Sukkim that we find in Yeshayahu. He says that whoever drinks, of course it means drinks at a party, right? And there are four different types of instruments, musical instruments playing over there, then he's going to bring five forms of punishment to the world. Shenemar, and he quotes, it's written in Yeshayahu, it says, Hoi mashkimi baboker sheikha yudofu. Woe unto those who wake up early in the morning because they are pursuing strong drink, right? In other words, they can't wait to start the day drinking. Ma'acharei v'nesha yayin latikeim, and they stay up late at night, and wine inflames them, right? V'hoya kinor v'nevel tofe chalil, right? And there is kinor is the harp, nevel is like a lute, tof is like a drum, or something of that nature. Maybe it's something like the castanets or something. You know what I mean? It looks like a little drum, and they have things that rattle back and forth, that jingle back and forth. And the chalil, of course, the chalil is the flute, right? So, Nevel is, they translate as a lute, and kinor is translated as a harp. Of course, today, a lute is an old stringed instrument. It looks something like an old banjo, I would say. Closer to a banjo, a lute.
The big barrel, the big...
Right. It has a big stomach and strings, right? The yayin mishtehem. Right. And there is wine at their banquets. The espoal adeshem lo yabitu. But yet they do not look upon God's handiwork. In other words, all that they want is pleasure, intoxication, having a good time,
and not to look upon
God's handiwork. So Mark Sivacharon, so what do we find written subsequently? It says, Lochein golo ami mibli das, therefore is my people going into exile without even knowing why it is. So what does it mean? Ami bibli das, he says, Shegorim golos lo'olam, right? They cause, as a result of their actions, that golos should come to the world, right? Exile. Then the pasuk continues, Chvodo miseva ov, and the glory will vanish into hunger. So that means Shemavim ro'ov le'olam. And what else do they do then? That they bring famine to the world, right? The hamono tzacha, and the multitude becomes thirsty. So he says, "Soma shegovim la Torah, shatishtaka polom nehod." He says, "We're not talking about thirst, physical thirst, but we're talking about the fact that there is no longer a spiritual thirst for learning, for Torah, and as a result, the Torah will be forgotten even by those who studied it, if they indulge in the." In banqueting and drinking and everything else, they will forget even what they learned.
Yeah.
Right. By Yishach Odom, says Yishayahu. So man becomes low, by Yishpal Ish, and the important person becomes lowly. Shegomim Shiflus, that they bring about lowliness. That's what I want to say. My tongue is playing tricks. That they bring about lowliness. Lesono shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, literally to the enemy of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it doesn't mean that. It means that they bring about lowliness to the Rebbeinu Shalom. In other words, they put the Rebbeinu Shalom where? In a low place where the Rebbeinu Shalom becomes very unimportant to them, or even, it leads to what we call Chilul Hashem. People see these people getting drunk and everything else. They say, this is what Yiddishkeit teaches, to go get drunk and have a good time and not to learn, not to pay attention, not to live a decent life, a life of ethics and so on. The ain ish, so he explains, why does it say ish, it says by ish pal ish, right? So he says, ain ish shall HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The word ish here in the pasuk refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, shenemar, as the pasuk says, Hashem ish melchama. So the Rebbeinu Shalom is also referred to as an ish, okay? Then the pasuk continues, the yenei kevohim tishpalna, and the eyes of those who are on high will become lowly. So it says, shegomin shiflu shal Yisrael. They bring about that Israel itself should fall into lowliness. Umaksiv acharav, and then what follows after that? Zvith mochein, yirchivo sha'ol nafsho. As a result, Sheol, which means the grave, literally, has opened wide its desire for Arav Piho, and it opens wide its mouth, Licho, without any limit, the Yorad Hadora Vahamoino Shono Va'aleisbo, and all its glory, its multitude, the shouting, the noise, the happiness, all that will disappear as a result of, you know, the kind of behavior that they exhibit. So I think we'll stop at this particular point. My throat is giving out. And okay, so next week, we will continue. As you can see, we're going down the home stretch.
I was talking with the rabbi about
what we should continue with once we make the scene, because as you can see, we only have this daf and then one more daf to finish.
Before Pesach?
I don't know if we could do it before Pesach or not, because time is running out for that.
Yeah.
But we could do it shortly after we get back.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be better anyway, because then we'd have more time to arrange to make the scene. I was thinking maybe we should study Rosh Hashanah.
All right, tonight is the 24th of the month of March. It's our last session prior to Pesach. We are still on Soto. We are on Mem Ches, Omid Beis, the third line from the top. And we will continue at this particular point. The Mishnah said, Mishameis and Nevi'im Horishonim, when the first prophets died, then in that case, that was the end of the Urim Betumim. So now, the Gemara is discussing that. And they want to know, first of all, Mam Nevi'im Rishonim, who are they? So Omar Rav Huna says, Zed Ovid Shmuel Ushlomo, says that the Nevi'im Rishonim were talking about David, Shmuel, and Shlomo. And the implication would be that, even though David and Shlomo were kings, and Shmuel was a prophet, but nevertheless, it was that particular period in which we still had evidence, based, of course, on the, on the Tanakh, on the Torah, that we know that the Urim Thummim was still in effect. Okay, so this is the opinion of Rav Huna. Right, Rav Nachman Omar, he said, B'yamei David, in the days of David, Zimnin Salik, V'zimnin Lo Salik. At times, the Urim Thummim were effective, they were working, and at other times, the Urim Thummim didn't work. Now, how do we know that? So he quotes two different incidents. Says, Shaharei Shoal Tzodok, V'ol Salo, Shoalev Yasser, V'lo Ol Salo. Okay. First of all, let's take a look at the Rashi for a moment, because Rashi goes into a better explanation at this particular place. Okay, if we take a look in the Rashi on the right-hand column over there, and so he says, Zim and Salik, he says, Be'amim, Oilim Be'yodom, at times the Urim Betumim actually worked for them, Shena'anim, that they gave an answer, right? Be'amim, Shelo Alo Be'yodom, but at other times it didn't work. When David fled because of his son Avshalom, remember, who had started a war against his father, trying to kill his father and become king instead, so Yotzim Yerushalayim, he had to leave Yerushalayim, and then Shoal Tzodok Be'urim Betumim, so Tzodok, who was a Kohen, inquired of the Urim Betumim Be'olsalom, and it worked for him. Why? Sheheshivuhu, because he answered him and he gave directions that he should tell David HaMelech how to proceed. On the other hand, the Shoal of Yotzer, then of Yotzer inquired also the Umatumim right below also, but it didn't work out for him. Shenamar, as the Pasuk says, Vayal Evyasar, that Evyasar went up. Now, what does it mean, it went up? It means that he left King David because it wasn't working out. And as they explain, it means Shanistalik bin Hakahuna. He gave up being the Kohen, the official Kohen to King David. Bipnei Shalona Anoa bi Urm Betum, right? Because he was not answered in the Urm Betum. Hochitanya, and this is something that we learned, the Seder Olam is one of the earliest history books that dates back to the time of the latter days of the Talmud. And we find this story over there. Gabe Oron, in connection with the Oron. Uvevorcha b'pnei Avshalom, yotza imo, ad she'olo b'balei hazesim. When David fled because of Avshalom, so Evyasa went together with him, right, until they came to the heights of, Har Hazesim. B'nishal b'urim v'tumim, and he inquired at that time of the Urim v'tumim, how to proceed. V'nistalek Evyasa m'lakhuna gedola. And Evyasa gave up being the Kohen Gadol in the days of David. So instead, who took over the position? Nichnas Tzadok Tachtov. Then Tzadok took over the position of being Kohen Gadol, as it is written, Vayomer HaMelech LeTzadok Hosheves Aron, that the king said to Tzadok, bring back the Aron which had been taken from Yerushalayim, so not to fall into Avshalom's hands, and bring it back to Yerushalayim. So from this, we learn what? That sometimes the Urim Betumim worked, and sometimes they didn't, but at any rate, we see that historically they were still being employed in the days of King David. Yes, David.
I have two questions.
Sure.
Not particularly on this passage, but just okay. First, in anywhere, the Salek, is that in relation to the word they use in modern Hebrew, which means to to remove or to?
Yes. Yeah.
The second question I have is about where the Rashi is. I guess maybe I've been away.
The Rashi is over on the right hand, the upper right hand corner over here.
But is it normally on the inside, or am I?
Okay, you are absolutely right that normally we would find it on the inside, and Tosfos would be on the outside, but there's no Tosfos over here.
Okay.
So when there's no Tosfos, then they'll put a Rashi to the right, and then they'll continue on the left.
Okay? Great.
All right, so that's where we are right now. All right. Masav Rabba Bar Shmuel. So Rabba Bar Shmuel asked the following kasha. He says, "Vayehi nidrosh alehim kol yemei zecharyo hamevin biros alehim." All right. He quotes a pasuk that we find written in Divrei Hayomim in this particular case. In other words, the Book of Chronicles, and the subject at this particular time happens to be King Uzziah. Okay. So King Uzziah wanted to find out, instruction, what does God require, right? Vayehi lidrosh alehim, right? In other words, it came to pass that he wanted to seek God, kol yemei Zechariah, right? All the days. In other words, as long as Zechariah was alive, then who was this Zechariah? He says, hamevin biros alehim. This Zechariah was an expert in God's appearances. In other words, he was a prophet who could interpret it. So they asked the following question, right? My love, the Urim Betumim. So certainly then it must be, how did the prophet inquire for King Uzziah? If King Uzziah wanted to know what was God's opinion in this particular case, it had to be with the Urim Betumim. So in other words, it would indicate what? That the Urim Betumim was still around even at a later period, not simply in the days of David and Shlomo, right? In a much later period, they were still there during the later period of the Beis HaMikdash HaRishon, right, the first temple. So the Gemara says, well, not necessarily so. It says, B'Neviim. Maybe it's possible that they had prophecies, right? But the prophets did not have to make use of what? Of the Urim Betumim. So, that being the case, we still are not certain whether the Urim Betumim was still in existence at this period. So now the Gemara says, Toshba. come listen, he says. Smishachora beis hamikdash rishon botlu ore migrash ufosku or metumin. We have a beraisa which says that when the first beis hamikdash was destroyed, at that time two things came to an end. One of them was the Ore Migrash, and the second one was the Urim V'Tumim. Okay? Now, of course, what are the Ore Migrash? The answer is, if you remember, that the cities, that there were cities set aside for the Levium, right? And then, not only that, but it says not only are the cities places where the Levium ought to be living and given to them, but also they had to have a field around them. So this was a special type of habitation given to the Levium, and this came to an end with the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, obviously, because, you know, the Nebuchadnezzar's army destroyed everything, okay? Then, the other thing it says is that the Urim V'Tumim came to an end. So if it's Pascha Urim V'Tumim, it would show that what? That as long as the Beis HaMikdash HaRishon was in existence, then the Urim V'Tumim was still there, according to this. Okay? Ufosak Melech Beis David, right? And also, of course, not only did, you know, the Urim V'Tumim and the Urim Migrash come to an end, but also there was no longer any king descendant of the house of David. Okay? Because we're not talking now about what happened when they tried to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash. So at that particular time, they had a leader who was a descendant of King David, and that was Zerubbabel. But he was never a king, because first of all, Eretz Yisrael at that time was a vassal of the Persians. Remember that the Persians gave the permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and for Jews to come back, right? But they did not permit him to be called, you know, the king of the Jewish people. So obviously that ceased. And then when we come to a later period, we had no king at all during this first part of the Second Temple era. There was no Jewish king. Finally, you had, of course, the rebellions led by Matas Yohu and Yehuda Maccabi, and so, you know, the Hashmonaim against the against the Greeks, right? So when that happened, then finally there was a Jewish king. But the Hashmonaim were not really descendants of the house of David. So if that's the case, then we could say that the Gemara, what it says over here, that Fosak Melech Meis David, it means literally that there was no longer any Jewish king who was a descendant of the house of David. Of course, in Yotza Hashem, if the Mashiach comes, so he'll be Mashiach ben David. But at this point, we don't have a candidate yet, okay? So, Yotza Hashem, maybe we'll be able to see it with our own eyes. Halabai Omer. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Uzziyahu, Yotam, Achaz, Yechizkiyahu. Okay? And then after Yechizkiyahu, then you had the last group of kings, you know, such as, for example, Menashe and Yoshiyahu. Then, of course, you have the days of Yirmiyahu HaNavi already. Then you have the last kings, you know, like Yehoyakim, Yechonia, and finally Tzidkiyahu. He was considered a good king, right? But at the same time, he also suffered from leprosy at the end of his reign. And the reason is that he didn't behave himself as he should have behaved. Yeah. But he was successful in other ways. Now, he lived during the time when Yeshayahu was prophesying. Because that we know, I mean, well, I quoted to you before, it's written at the very beginning, Yeshayahu, you know, Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amos, Asher Chazon, Yehuda Yishlaim, Mimei Uziyahu, Yotam, Achaz, Yechizkiyahu. Okay? So they were the kings at the time of Yeshayahu. All right. So, to continue over here, So it says right before Tzach Melton based on it. Now it says, V'im l'chashcha Adam l'mar, and if a man should whisper unto you and say, V'yomer ha-tirshos olayhem asher lo yochlu mekodesh ha-kodashim aramot kohen le'urum le'tumim. Now this is a pasuk that we find in Ezra. Okay, and of course Ezra, as we know, is quite late already, because this is already at the time of what? The beginning of the Second Temple era. Okay? So the pasuk says that the Tirshasa, meaning in this particular case, you know, the head of the Jewish community, okay, said unto them, meaning to the Kohanim, right? He said, Asher lo yochlu mikodesh hakadoshim, that they are not to eat of the Kodesh HaKodoshim, in other words, of the most holy type of sacrifices, Ad Amod Kohen Urim V'Tumim, until there should arise a Kohen with Urim V'Tumim. So what would this prove? Okay, we would say, A, it would prove that Urim V'Tumim were available during the time of what? The cycle based on things, right? Why? Because did the Kohanim eat Kodesh Kodoshim in the days of the Second Temple? The answer is yes. As part of the sacrifices, they ate, chatos, the osham, which was strictly for the kehanim, as well as other things like the mincha, which were also given unto them, and so on. So they did eat of these holy of holies. So therefore, the implication of this pasuk would mean what? That Urim V'Tumim were also there. But we know, what did it say? It said that the Urim V'Tumim were no longer there. So how do we resolve that? So the Gemara says, alright, so he says, Emor lo, then say unto this person who tells you this particular pasuk, he says, you know what the meaning of the pasuk is? He says, it's ke'odim she'im melechadeiro, as if it's a person telling, you know, his somebody else, Ad sheyichyu meisim, v'yovah Mashiach ben David. In other words, until the time when the dead will be revived and the Mashiach ben David will come. In other words, who knows when it's ever going to happen. So of course, what is the implication over here? Not to take the words of Shosa literally, that, you know, that they couldn't eat kosher kadoshim until the time, you know, that they'll have the coin with Urim V'Tumim, because as we see, they were permitted to eat it, but the Urim V'Tumim were not there. Okay. El Amar Rab Nachman by Yitzchak. So now Rab Nachman by Yitzchak comes along. Yeah. Okay.
Literature, right?
Yeah, right.
Say that in the time of Beit HaMikdash Hashini, the Kohanim, Afulata, Kodesh Kodesh.
Yeah, that we know, of course.
I mean, this is very interesting. I mean, then there really was like a hafara according to this. They should have been doing it, but they didn't.
Yeah. Okay. So therefore, he's explaining that the business, you know, until a Cain should arise with Urim V'Tumim, it's the same as saying until Mashiach will come. But
I take that. That's whole thing is that
right.
You shouldn't do it. I mean, this is it. This is not.
Well, but nevertheless, we know that when they restored the Beis HaMikdash and they reinstituted sacrifices, kavodas over there, so certainly then the Kohanim went back again to functioning as Kohanim. And you know what the Kohanim were entitled to eat, including the, you know, kosher kodoshim, that they were entitled to eat. Remember again that we make a distinction between different types of sacrifices. Okay, according to the law of the Torah, the old law, the burnt offering, nobody gets. The only thing that the priest gets out of it actually is or habehema, that they would take off the skin of the animal, so that the hide of the animal, and that he could sell and make a few bucks that way. Okay, but then we have chatos and osha. Chatas is a sin offering, Oshem is a trespass offering. I mean, I'm using the fancy English terms for it. But according to the law of the Torah, these two types of sacrifices were eaten only by Zichrei Kehuna, in other words, male Kohanim, right? And these are called Kodshei Kodoshim, okay? Huh? All right, now, then we have what we call, minor Kodshim, right? Kodshim Kalim, okay? Which is the term that we use in Hebrew. They include Shlomim, and among Shlomim you have the Korban Todah, you have the Korban, you have other types, okay? So these are eaten by the people who bring them, and a portion is given to the Kohanim, and a portion is burnt on the Mizbeah, okay? So these are no longer just the exclusive domain of the Kohanim, but that they are, whoever brings it, you know, is entitled to share it, you see. So we have different types that belong, you know, to that particular category. So by Kodesh Kodoshim over here, I'm positive that what the Gemara is trying to say is simply that, you know, they they certainly were permitted to eat in the Beis Hamikdash those sacrifices that were reserved for the Kohanim, but at the same time the Urim Thummim were not there, contrary to the implication that would seem to, you know, to be derived from the Pasuk that the Urim Thummim did exist in the days of the Second Temple. They did. Okay. So Elo Rav Nachman by Yitzchok. So Rav Nachman Yitzchok says, okay, we said before that who are the Neviim Rishonim? We said there was David, Shmuel, and Shlomo, right? But now he gives a different interpretation. He says, no, by the Neviim Rishonim, he says, you know who they are? It's La Fuke, Bechagai, Sechaya, Malochi, Dachroinim Ninu. It means that these, the Neviim Rishonim, are the prophets who existed during the entire period of the first Beis Hamikdash. And that excludes Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, because these three did not begin their prophecy until the time that the people of Israel came back to Eretz Yisrael and, you know, they rebuilt the second Beis Hamikdash. So they are Neviim Achronim, okay? Of course, I'm not talking right now about in the Tanakh our classification. In the Tanakh, the classification is different than what the Gemara here has to say. In the Tanakh, after all, what does Tanakh mean? Means that it's Torah, Neviim, and Ksuvim, right? In other words, Torah, meaning the first five books of the Bible, right? From Bereishis through Devarim. And then Neviim, prophets, by that they include everything beginning with the book of Yehoshua, until the end of what? Until the end of Malachim Beis. Until the end of Malachim Beis. So that's the classification for Neviim Rishonim. Okay? Then we have Neviim Achronim. And who are they? So they include both prophets who prophesied during the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, and finally those prophets who prophesied in the time when Jews came back to Eretz Israel to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash in the second Commonwealth, okay? So in other words, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel are grouped as part of the Neviim Achronim. But so are the Treyosa, many of whom also lived in the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, as for example, let's say Hoshea, and Micha, and Amos. We know that they prophesied during the days of the first Beis HaMikdash yet, okay? But Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi, definitely they were among the last ones. With the others, in general, we figure that they prophesied also during the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, but in a later period, we're not altogether certain about the, exactly what is the chronology over there. Take, for example, Ovadia. obviously he's already aware of how the people of Edom behaved towards the people of Israel, and that was probably during the time when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and Jews, you know, were fleeing in all directions and trying to escape from the mountain. Okay, so it is not the same definition as we find over here in the Gemara. Okay, but when the Mishnah says, you know, that the Urim and Thummim ceased with the end of what? With the end of the Nevi'im Mishonim, so now we have a new classification, that of Rabbi Nachman by Yitzchak, who says that the Nevi'im Mishonim, they include La'afuke means to exclude, literally to leave out. Okay? Of course it's Aramaic, I mean it's not Hebrew, okay? Because in Hebrew La'afik has a somewhat different idea. It means to distribute something. Right. Right. Of course, you see it on cans these days, you know.
Hafakar,
Rashid, or something, you know. Main distribution and so on, things like that, you know. Who, you know, distributed by this and this and so on, you know.
Okay,
yeah,
you're inviting me to waste time.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I had this Dakish, it's like a Hebrew software program, so. And this very, very good computer program, Christian thought that he's like French Canadian descent or whatever. So I'm asking him to put it in, and you know, part of it is in English, it's well in Hebrew.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden it shows up like Miller Levine Mapi Kim. He looks at me and says, Mapi Kim. I think for a minute, I'm looking at it, I'm thinking it's about Hapi, I'm looking at it, and huh. Must be the distributors,
right,
of the software.
Right. Should really be pronounced Mafikim.
Mafikim, thank you.
Right, yeah.
Thank you. That's right.
It's all right.
Oh, it isn't, but it's our
right.
It is
our okay.
Mafikim, thank you.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, so.
Right, thank you.
Okay, so as we get back to Reb Nachman, by Yitzchak, it says, Manavi Barishonim, that's Mafikim Bechagis Chavim Malachim, right? The Achronim. The Torah Rabbanim. As our sages taught, Mishemesu Chagai Zachariah Malachi, that when Chagai Zachariah Malachi died, then in that case, Nistalka Ruach HaKodesh Bisrael, the Holy Spirit departed from Israel. In other words, they were the last of the Nevi'im, and from that point on, you no longer had prophets, you know, in the original sense of the word. Okay? But nevertheless, it doesn't mean that there was no divine inspiration anymore from that particular point. Why? Because Hoya Mishtam Shimavas Kol. They still were able to get from time to time a bas kol. A bas kol, of course, is like a heavenly voice that would come and say something. And now they quote Shapa Machas. Happened one time. They were gathered together having dinner in the attic or the upper story of Beis Guria, which was located in Yericho. As you can see, Yericho was a Jewish city for many, many years until Arafat came along. Yeah. And you know, they still tried to maintain a little Jewish presence in the form of a yeshiva that they go to. But they have to go in and have to leave at sunset and so on. All right. But once upon a time, it was a flourishing Jewish community. So at any rate, while they were gathered over there, Nidda Lehen Bas Kol in Hashemayim, a Bas Kol literally was given unto them from the heavens, right? The Yomra, and this is what the Bas Kol said. It said, Yesh Bochem Odem Echad, among you, there is one man, Shera'uyi Shatishra Shechinu Olam, who is worthy enough that the Shechinu should descend and should inspire him. In other words, you know, should be like a prophet. He should, you know, he should have been like a prophet. Had he lived in an earlier period, he would have been an official prophet. So, who it is? So, the answer is, Elashein Dora Royulachach, right? But unfortunately, his generation is not worthy the fact that they should have a real prophet, you know, who has the Ruach Shechina on him. So, Nosnu Einayhem Behilul HaZokein. So everybody looked at Hillel HaZokein because they, you know, they knew that he was the person who would have been worthy enough to deserve the divine inspiration as a prophet. Uchshemeis, and when he died, Hisbiduhu, they gave the following hesped for him. Hey Chosin, the pious man. Hey Onav, the modest man, right? Talmido Shel Ezra, the man who was a disciple of Ezra. Doesn't mean actually, of course, that he lived at the time of Ezra, because he lived, you know, quite a bit later. But the point is that just as Ezra had restored the Torah from the people of to the people of Israel, so that the Torah should not be forgotten, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, so likewise we find over here, you know, that Hillel, through the force of his personality and his teachers and so on, that he was a master teacher of Torah to the people of Israel. Then, similar story, okay? Vishuv Pamacheres, and another time, this time we were gathered in an upper story in Yavne. Nitolehem Baskol ben Hashemayim, so Baskol came to them. Say the second time, it said, okay, Yesh Bachem Odom Echod, there is one man among you, Sharoi Shatisha Shechino Olov, who is worthy that the Shechino should rest upon him, Elishain Dora Zakoyin Lachach, except that his generation are not worthy enough that this should happen. So Nosnu Einehem Shmuel HaKotan. So they all looked at Shmuel HaKotan. So when he died, Hisbiduhu, they gave him also a similar hesped. They said, hey, Onav, woe for the one who, you know, this modest man who has passed away. Hey, Chosin, for the pious person who has passed away from us. Talmido Shel Hillel, the disciple of Hillel. The Afhu, and he too, meaning Shmuel HaKotan, Omar Bishas Bisoso, he had a certain amount of divine inspiration at that moment, and he gave them the following prophecy. And he said, Shimon the Yishmuel Lecharba. He says that Shimon, in this case happens to be Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, right? And Yishmuel was Yishmuel ben Elisha, who was the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. They are going to be slain by the sword, of course, the Romans, right? Because after, you know, the Romans put down the Jewish rebellion, then they killed what we call the Asura Haruge Malchus, the 10 martyrs, and these two were among them, so they were killed by the sword. The Chavruhi and their colleagues, Liktola, will also be killed. Ushaor Avola Viza and the rest of the people will be despoiled by the Romans. The Akon Sagian Asidul Mesi Alamo, and great Soros are going to come to the people of Israel. So, we'll take a look at the Rashi for a moment. Yeah. I don't know that we have any real figures, but we do know. But the how much? Where did you hear that? Where do you hear these things? Must have an underground channel someplace. No. Huh? No, there weren't 60 million people in Israel either at that time. What I can tell you is that sociologists tried to figure out, you know, what was the population of the Roman Empire,
right.
And they assumed that the Jewish people, with also those who were not formally Jews, but who were what in the Greek were called Theos Abominai, which means God-fearing people, like Yirei Hashem, right? In other words, people who were willing to undertake in general to live a Jewish life, but you know, without committing themselves 100% to being Jews. But they estimate that roughly 20% of the Roman Empire at that particular point was Jewish. Of course, after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, and then there were riots and other things, not just in you know, in Eretz Yisrael, but also in places like in Alexandria, there was a massacre of Jews, and in some other cities there were massacres of Jews. Okay, so the Jewish population was reduced, and of course the Roman government also put a ban upon the practice of Yiddishkeit. And then when the Christians came along and they took over Rome, then you know, there were new tzoras that arose for the Jewish people. That, for example, they didn't permit any more conversions. If a person converted, he would be put to death and things like that. So as a result, the Jewish population, you know, I suppose I could say was decimated, and certainly at any rate, you know, the population was greatly reduced as a result of the wars and the death and everything else that happened.
Was that during this time?
Yeah, that would be from the second Beis HaMikdash, right. During the time of the Roman occupation, the Roman destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it also spread from east to west. I mean, look, the Jews were they were a victim. They were a victim of the non-Jewish world, unfortunately. Okay? All right. Anyway, so, yes, I started to say, let's take a look at the Rashi for a moment, because he explains this. Okay. You see where it says Shimon v'Yishmael? Right opposite, you see where it says Hagoz Habach? In the column, you see it? All right, so right opposite to it, you see Shimon v'Yishmael. So first of all, it explains which Shimon and which Yishmael we're talking about. It says, Rabban Shimon, Choyen Nosi, he was the Nosi, in other words, he was the head of the Sanhedrin. He was a descendant of Hillel, incidentally. And Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, who was the Kohen Gadol. Shaharagosam Malchus Yavan, that the Greek government murdered them. Now, obviously, it wasn't the Greek government, but it was the Roman government that murdered them, okay? But, you know, because of the censor, they had to change the word, you know, either from Edom or Romy or something like that, and they made it into Yavan, okay? Then remember he said that they would be killed lecharba, by the sword. Sha'asidil nehoreg b'chorev, right? That they are destined to be killed by the sword. But the others, it says, are also destined to death at the hands of the Roman, right? So Rashi explains the Sha'ar Misas, that they would be subjected to other deaths. Kegon, for example, this of course, remember we learned this towards the end of the Gemara Brachas, where we learned that Rabbi Akiva, in his case, Shesorku Besorim Masrekos, Pifio Shabarza, that they tore his flesh with combs, sharp-toothed combs of iron, Gedoma Bebrochas, as we learned in Gemara Brochas, Daf Samachav. Or for Rabbi Chananya ben Chetradio, another case, Shenisraf, he was burnt. This we find in the story, it's in Avodah Zorah we find it, okay? That he was burnt together with the Sefer Torah wrapped around him. And the Romans set him on fire with the Sefer Torah burnt around them, and he had a vision as he was dying. And he said that Gevilin Nisrofim, the parchment itself is being burnt, but the Osios Porchos Ba'avir, the letters themselves are flying in the air. In other words, you can destroy the parchment, but you cannot destroy what the Torah has to teach, because that comes min Hashemayim. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, the Christians appointed censors to review the printed editions of the Talmud, and they would take out what they didn't like. Yeah? Not just Middle Ages, but later in the time of the Renaissance. After all, printing first developed during the time of the Renaissance. Prior to that, everything was written out by hand. They wrote it, you know, on parchment, or they had what they called a codex, which would mean, you know, that they would collect sheets of parchment or papyrus or something and bind them together like a book, okay? What? No, the Renaissance started about the 15th century, okay? Yeah. So one of the things that developed in the Renaissance was the invention of printing. So once they began printing, actually the first book to be printed in its entirety happened to be a Hebrew Bible, okay? So then they began to print the Gemara, okay? Famous Italian printer by the name of Bamberg, and he put out, you know, the Bible, he put out the Talmud, okay? He printed it. But the government had censors, and if they didn't like a reference, so then they would force a change in the text, or they would delete a text, or something like that.
Where,
yes?
Apostates? Where would they get?
Sometimes. Sometimes they were apostates who figured, you know, that they would curry favor in the eyes of the people who employed them. Or in other cases, there were people who thought that they were great Hebrew scholars. You know.
And
yeah, you have them. You know, they can read Bob Barber, so that makes them into a Hebrew scholar, you see. Well, that we don't know altogether. But, you see, we do have early editions of the Talmud, like what they call the Munich edition, okay? Where they had an earlier version of the Talmud, which has been preserved in many cases, and they can take a look at the readings, and from time to time you can see the difference in the reading the way we have it today in the text as compared to their reading. I also have to add that the Gemara that we use right now is primarily the Gemara which was printed in Russia. And, you know, they simply come and they photograph it these days. One time, you know, in Russia, they said it. But in modern business, you know, all that they have to do is to take a photograph and then they print from the photograph, okay? So the Russians also, they had censors working. I used to have copies, I still have, Sidurim and other things and so on. And in Russian, it says there's Volyno Censurio, which means approved by the censor, and then they give the date in which it was read by the censor. So it had to meet the approval of the censor also. There are probably some very, very valuable and precious things in the archives of the Vatican, but they're not releasing it to us, unfortunately. Yeah, well, we would like to get hold of these things. All right, let's do a little bit more right now. So as we see, yeah, okay. The third person that is quoted by Rashi, by the way, is Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. Again, the Gemara mentions him in several places, that he knew that if he would pass on the smicha, this is again, it's Gemara in Sanhedrin, okay, that, you know, he was facing death for teaching Torah. So nevertheless, he refused to bow to the Roman authorities. Instead, he took his disciples into a field where they would not be near any city, so that the city should not be punished because of the fact that he was teaching Torah. And then the Roman soldiers came and they surrounded him and they pierced him with 300 spears. They killed him. Right. Yehuda ben Bava. So he was also one of the Asura Haruge Malchus, you see. So, yeah. So all the time, you know, primarily during the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, or maybe beginning first with the destruction in the second Beis HaMikdash, and then continue with the Bar Kokhba revolt, because actually some of the people mentioned here were earlier, like Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who lived at the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, as compared to Rabbi Akiva, who already lived, you know, at least a half century later than that. Okay. Here, when the Shammai were not killed by the Romans, and they lived earlier, they were earlier authorities. Okay. So, you know, it's important for us to have some sense of the history, so that we can sort of place it in a, you know, a better chronological context to understand these things.
That's very hard to get from.
Yeah.
Right. Make that clear. I think the average Jew who reads this, it seems like it's contemporary.
Yeah, that it all happened at the same time. That's right. That would be the impression.
Same.
That's correct.
Day.
But that's because they were all victims of Roman persecution, and so they lumped it all together.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. All right. And it says the Afal Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava bikshu lomar. And also for Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, they also wanted to give the same hesped, saying, "Hey Chosid, alas for this pious man. Hey Anav, alas for this modest man." In other words, the same type of hesped that they gave for Hillel and for Shmuel HaKotan, Elosh and Nitrufa Shoah, but unfortunately the time was very bad. She'ein Maspidan LaHaruge Malchus. That because the Roman government did not permit hespedim for those who were killed by the Roman government. They did not want the Jews, in other words, to to become aroused again, to rebel against them, and so therefore the government clamped down on the Jewish authorities, and they said you're not allowed to give such a hesped anymore. Okay. It's 8:45. I think I'm going to call it a night right now. Okay. Hayom Yom, or Ha'erev Ha'erev. Okay. Anyway, tonight is the 14th in the month of April, right? And we are still on Memches Amud Beis, that's Sota 48B, continuing where we left off the previous session. All right. The Mishnah says, B'shechor Beis HaMikdash, Botel HaShomim. Mishnah says that when the temple was destroyed, then there was no more Shamir. And so, of course, we have to say, what is the Shamir? So, right, the Shamir, as we see, was a worm which had magical power, right? Namely, it was able to cut through stones, and therefore it was a tremendous help, as we'll discover, to Shlomo HaMelech. All right. But we'll also discover another opinion that relates it also to something else. Okay?
He said the Shamir was not available anymore.
Yeah, right. Just, that's it. It disappeared. It ceased the operation. Okay? So, Tana Rabbanan, we had the following teaching. The rabbi said that Shomir, Shebo Bono Shlomir, Beis HaMikdash, that the Shomir is, you know, that creature with whose help King Solomon built the Beis HaMikdash. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, V'habayis behima noso, even shleimor maso nivna, right? And the house, meaning, of course, the temple, when it was being built, was made of complete stones. In other words, the stones were already cut beforehand, right? And maso nivna, the question is, what does it mean, the word maso? Normally the word maso means travel. In other words, the implication probably is that it was brought from whatever source, you know, they had quarried the stone. And it was cut at the quarry, and this is the implication over here. So, and hadvarim kir savon de Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that it's exactly the way it says. In other words, that there was no cutting of the stones of the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim itself. So Amar lo Rav Nechemya, so Rav Nechemya said unto him, V'chi yefshal emarkein, how could you say such a thing? Valok for Neymar, don't we have another pasuk in which it says, Kolela avonim yikoros, these were all very heavy stones. Yakor usually means precious, but over here it means more in the sense that it was heavy. All these were heavy stones. And then the pasuk continues, says, Megora rose from a gera, which means that they were sawn with a saw. In other words, you know, they were chiseled out, they were sawn and sawn as they were.
Well,
so, right. So, of course, the raise of question, I mean, about the fact, you know, that in connection with the Mizbeach, it's written, you know, that no sanif alehem barzel, you're not allowed to lift up any iron on them. In other words, you're not supposed to use any iron implements. And as the Gemara explains, the reason being that iron is used in order to shorten the life of man. And the Beis HaMikdash and the Mizbeach is in order to prolong the life of men, so that it's not fit, you know, to use something like this in order to build the Mizbeach.
How
yes.
far did they have to carry these?
Tremendous distances, but
where were they carried?
Actually, you know, it doesn't necessarily, there is no 100% indication. It mentions places, but the question is, what is the geography of these places, you understand? However, I can tell you that Eretz Yisrael is such a stony area that there are plenty of quarries of stone even in the vicinity of Yerushalayim. But, you know, when you start to schlep heavy stones, you really had to have a tremendous amount of workers. And this is one of the problems that was raised, that when Shlomo HaMelech decided to build the Beis HaMikdash, he actually levied workers, you know, from among the people, and he had thousands of workers who had to do the schlepping and the cutting and everything else. And of course, you know, if you were summoned to spend, you know, a month doing this duty, and they were away from home and everything, it didn't make actually for great popularity. I mean, the result was a beautiful Beis HaMikdash, but there was certainly you know, some latent resentment among people who were forced to do this kind of work. And after the death of Shlomo, it came to the fore when his son Rechavam decided that he could be a tough guy and show, you know, that his father was a weakling as far as dominion over the people was concerned. He was going to be tough. And the result was, of course, that led by Yeravim ben Nevat, 10 of the tribes seceded. They said, "What? You know, we have no share in the descendant of Jesse." In other words, the descendant of the King David, you know, right. Or his son Rechavam. So it's led to the split of the kingdom. So this is one of the problems that arose from the building of the Beis HaMikdash. But I would say that probably a good deal of the stone actually came from the area of Yerushalayim itself. However, when it came to the wood, this is already a different story.
Lebanon.
Right. Actually, they cut them down in the mountains of Lebanon. Then they schlepped them down to the seacoast. They lashed them together into rafts. They floated them down the seacoast from Lebanon. You know, you had the ports of Tyre and Sidon, Tzoret Sidon, they call them in Hebrew, and they went down as far as Yafo.
And
then they had it taken from Yafo to Yerushalayim. And, you know, anybody who's traveled from the Tel Aviv area, you know, to Yerushalayim, you know that after you go for a few miles on flat ground, all of a sudden you come to mountainous areas over there, and it's not easy.
Right.
It wasn't easy in those days, it hasn't been easy in our own days. Of course, now, Baruch Hashem, they have a decent highway, you know.
Yeah,
but I remember before they built the new roads, when you had to go on the old road from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. Of course. And of course, you know, during the war for independence back in 48, the Arabs really killed a lot of Jews who were trying, you know, fighting in order to try to free the road, right? So that's one of the great heroic episodes. So, getting back over here, all right, so we have then a contradiction between Rabbi Yehuda and between Rabbi Nehemiah. Rabbi Yehuda assumes that everything was cut at the source, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in Yerushalayim there's no cutting, whereas Rabbi Nehemiah quotes a pasuk really in connection with the building of King Shlomo's house, the palace that he made, where it says that they were cut with swords. So obviously implements were used in Yerushalayim. So how do you resolve this particular contradiction? So so Im Kain, says the Gemara, if that's the case, Ma Talmud Lomar. That is, you know, if we accept Rabbi Nechemya's opinion that they did use swords and so on, so how do you explain then the pasuk that we quoted before, where it says Lo Nishma Babayis Behimin or so, that you know, there was no sound that could be heard in the temple itself when it was being built? So he says Shehoya Maski Mibachutz Amachtes Mibifnim. The answer is that they dressed the stones. In other words, you know, they prepared everything outside meaning outside Yerushalayim, and then they brought the finished product inside. So Omar Rabbi, so Rabbi said, Nirin Devrei Rabbi Yehuda Biavnei Mikdosh V'Divrei Nechemi Biavnei Beisal, says, I can see that the words of Rabbi Yehuda, who says that, you know, everything was done at the original source, right? When they first dug the stones, he says, that I can understand when it came to the stones of the Beis HaMikdash. But I also accept Rabbi Nechemya's opinion, the Avnei Beisel, meaning that when Shlomo built his house, then they did use saws and other implements in order to build it in Yerushalayim. So, inasmuch as Rabbi Nechemya said a minute ago that they used saws, right? So the question is now, Rabbi Nechemya, Shomer Lamayo, also. So, in accordance with Rabbi Nechemya's opinion, so what is the Shomer doing? Why did, what did they need it for? Right? Since they were doing the work, right? So, he, according to Rabbi Nechemya, he has a different use for it. He says, Mevoi Lei, we need it, Lechitatanya, in connection with another teaching, where it says Avonim Halolo in Kosvinosom Bidyo Mishum Shanema Pituchei Chosom. Okay, now which Avonim are we talking about over here? Which stones are we talking about? Here we're not talking about the stones of the Beis HaMikdash, but we're talking instead about the stones that appeared on the Choshen, you know, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, yeah. And also he had stones over here, you know, on the Kisvos HaEphod, you know, the shoulder straps of the ephod were also, there were precious stones. So, according to Rabbi Nechemya, and according to the opinion that, you know, he is relying on, these stones were not written on with ink. In other words, you didn't, you know, write permanent, you know, you didn't have ink used as a permanent marker. Because remember, what did they carry? They carried the names of the tribes of Israel. Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, right. So remember some time ago we had the question of what order they appeared, if you remember, okay? Mm-hmm. So these were not written with ink on the stones. Mishum Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Pituchei Chosam, which means that it has to be carved out as a seal is carved. Because a seal, I'm talking about, you know, the, like the signet rings that they use, the seals. I don't mean the animals. Okay, yeah. But a chosam, you know, in olden days, how did people attach? Right, they used a signet ring for their official signature, okay?
A hot flag.
Right. All right, whatever it is. In many cases, however, it wasn't necessarily letters that they had, although some they could do it, but in many cases what they also did, you know, was to have like a picture of a lion or a bear or something or other, you know, some something like that,
which identified,
right? So at any rate, you know, it says then that these stones have to be petuchei chosum, they have to be carved, but at the same time it says v'ein misartin aleihem be'ismil, you're not allowed to take a knife, an Ismail is like a pen knife or something like that, or a scalpel even, you know, any sharp knife, okay? Today they use the word, for example, for the knife that, let's say, that the Moyle has to use.
No.
It's also called an Ismail, okay?
What's it called?
An Ismail.
Ismail.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a sharp knife, all right? So you're not allowed to take a sharp knife and scratch it out either. Mishum Shenema B'milu Yisam, because it is written B'milu Yisam, which would mean literally in their fullness. So how do you get the names on? If you can't simply put ink on, or you cannot scratch it with a knife. So the answer says, Elokosev Alehim B'dyo. So he says, at first they wrote the names with ink on it, but not, you know, to be used as permanent marker, right? Umar Alehim Shamir, and then they show it to the Shamir, Mibachutz, right? Outside, in other words, outside where, not in the Beis HaMikdash, but outside where they were making it in order to bring in, the Hain Yifkois Me'alehen, and as a result, they split by themselves. In other words, the letters appeared hewn by themselves. You didn't have to cut them out, but the Shamir did the job. The Shomir read the writing and automatically,
yeah.
Right, and automatically, you know, like a template, so to speak, right?
somewhere.
Yeah.
Did they have that for the second building of the
no.
temple?
No, definitely not. It was only for the first based on Mikdash. Yeah. What? Yeah, right. According to, Rashi quotes the fact that there was a shade by the name of Ashmedai who had the power over the Shamir, and he was the one who gave it to Shlomo HaMelech. Okay. There are various legends, you know, about Shlomo HaMelech and the shade Ashmedai. Okay. So, at any rate, to finish this little section over here, and these quotes by him, they split by themselves. And he gives a comparison, Kita'eina zu, like a fig, Shenifkas b'imosachama, that splits by itself when, you know, you have the hot days of summer. The Yeno chaseo klum, and yet, even though it splits, nothing is missing from it. I assume that the kind of figs that they're talking about are like those that you have, you know, the round ones. You've seen figs, you know, that are round. What do they call them? Kalamirna or something like that. You know. Yeah. Mission figs, whatever, okay. I assume that's it. And I know, you know, they can split, you know. And yet, of course, the contents are still over there, okay? Uchavikozu, or gives another comparison. Like a valley, Shenifkas b'mosak shomen, which splits when the rainy season comes, right? And yet there's nothing missing from it. So likewise, the stones were able to be split, but at the same time, nothing was missing from the letters. Okay, that's why it says b'milu yosom. In other words, in their fullness, they were still there. The stones did not actually lose anything by the carving of the name. Tana Rabbanan, another teaching about the Shomer. It says Shomer Zeh. He says. Brioso Kisaora says the Shamir was a creature which was only the size of a Seora. Seora means a grain of barley. A grain of barley. You've seen barley. You know that the grain is very, very tiny. That's all that the Shamir was. But because of the fact, you know, that it had the ability to cut hard surfaces, so the question now becomes, so how did they preserve the Shamir in order to keep it, you know, between use? So this is what the Gemara is now going to address itself with. So first of all, they say Brioso Kisora, right? It's the size of a grain of barley. Umisheshes Himei Breshes Nivra, and it was created in the very first the 6 days of it was created during the 6 days of creation. So you remember in Pirkei Avos, after all we're now in the Pirkei Avos season, in the fifth Berek they have all kinds of numbers that they discuss, and says over there one of the Mishnayos, it says Asorah Devarim Nivru Be'er Shabbos Be'er Shmoshos, that there are 10 different things that the Rebbe Shalom created Erev Shabbos, in other words, it was on the sixth day of creation, just before the Shabbos, right? And it was Bein Hashmashos, it was a twilight period, okay? Because when does Bein Hashmashos begin? I follow the opinion that is the accepted one by most of the authorities, namely that sunset marks the beginning of Bein Hashmashos, and it goes up to, the time that's actually pitch black outside, okay? This is Bein Hashmashos. So during that time, and this twilight period before Shabbos actually began, that's when the Bein Hashmashos created these 10 magical things. So among them, for example, was Abair, in other words, the well of Miriam, right? And another thing that was created was the ability to carve out the Ten Commandments when it came time to give the Aseres Hadibros of Mount Sinai. These were some of the things that were magical. And among them was the Shamir, as mentioned over there. So, therefore, this relates then to what we have over here. It was created during those first 6 days of the creation. Right, so it was, it had magical properties. The ain called over Kosha Yochala Mumifonov, and there was nothing that was hard that could resist it. In other words, it was able to cut through anything that was hard. So the question is, so how could they keep it?
Yeah.
So the answer is, Korchinoso Bisfugin Shotzemer, they wrap it around with literally sponges of wool, in other words, cloth of wool or whatever, flax of wool, whatever you want to say. Umanichinoso, and then they place it the itne shalavar. Itne, question is, what does the word mean? But apparently it means like some kind of a jar or a tube or something like that, made of lead, avar. And it's Malaya Sube Saorin, and it's full of all kinds of the bran of barley. In other words, to be able to serve as insulation, right? So that, it was preserved well, and at the same time, because it was effective against hard surfaces, but if it was kept in soft surfaces, then in that case, it was quiescent to something. Okay? Omer Rabbi. Rabbi said, Omer Rabbi Yami. Rabbi Yami said, Mishachora Miklosh Rishon, when the first temple was destroyed, some other things also ceased. Botlo Shira Pardono Uschuchis Nevona. The Shira Pardono, Shira means what do you call
Shira?
No. It means the very expensive type of cloth that they use. Not linen, but sort of like velvet or something like that. You understand? Mm-hmm. And Pardonor apparently is some kind of a Persian word, which means it was a very expensive type of material used in order to make aristocratic garments. Okay, so that's it. It's a type of a velvet, as I said. Mm-hmm. Sure, right. Uzchuchis levana. Question is, what is uzchuchis levana? Literally, it means white glass. But the answer is that this is glass that was so fine that you could look through it, because in the while they were able to make glass already in ancient days, but usually you had to make it together with chemicals, and the chemicals would usually give a color. Sometimes you want dafka the color, you want the glass to be green, you want it to be blue, whatever it may be, and so on. Okay, so the type of chemicals that are used will determine that. But this was a pure, transparent glass, which apparently was very rare in those days. And so, therefore, they say that this ceased with the destruction of the first base Amikdash, okay? Tanya Nami Hachim. We likewise have learned along the same lines. Mishachora Mikdash Rishon, when the first base Amikdash was destroyed, Batla Shira Pandora, again, the same thing, with Zchuchis Levona,
And also, now they add something else. Verechev Barzel. And also, iron chariots also stopped. V'yeshomrim af yayin korush habo misnir. Hadomer ki yugulei devela. And they say also, at the same time, another thing ceased, and that is yayin korush, which comes from snir. The question is, what is yayin korush? So the answer is, this is wine which has become hardened. Become hardened.
Yayin korush?
Korush. Korush, right.
Korush.
Korush. So the question is, so what? So you have to realize, where is snir? The answer is that snir is actually part of the Hermon range, okay? And as we know, the Hermon has ice, snow and ice practically the entire year. I mean, where the Jews in Eretz Yisrael these days go for a ski, they go up to the Hermon, okay? Because there they have, lots of ice, even during, the warm weather, but still there's the covering of ice over there. So they made wine over there, and apparently the wine was mixed with snow and then allowed to freeze. Okay, so they could use it, I guess. First of all, it could be transported more easily. You didn't need jugs for that.
It was frozen,
right? And secondly, apparently as a result of the concentration, the wine actually in the freezing process, apparently the alcohol content also became a little bit strengthened as a result of it.
Wine
so,
jelly, yeah.
Right. So at any rate, as a matter of fact, I mean, in Gemara and Sukkah, which we're learning right now in the Daf Yomi, I came across it. There's a question. Maybe you could use this Yayin Korush for the Schach. Well, they decided that that's not such a hot idea. But the very fact that they even contemplate that indicates, that it was a commodity that was very well known in those days. And, that there was solid wine, okay? Right. After all, what is... Right. The schach, you have to have shegedulo bin akarka, right? Something that grows from the ground, is cut off from the ground, and is not mekabel tuma, cannot be susceptible to tuma. So apparently this meets all the qualifications, because it comes from the ground, and since the grapes originally grew from the ground and were cut up and everything, so that's why somebody suggested that this would also make kosher schach. Okay. Well, I can't imagine, reaching up to the roof and say, hey, what do you say? We have make a l'chaim with the Yayin Korush.
It also resembles cakes.
Right,
cakes.
Yeah, and then it says, this Yayin Korush, it comes from Snir, which as I say is the Hermon range. Adoma, which is similar to Gulei Dvela. In other words, it looks so hard that it looks already like fig cakes. Now, I don't mean, cake made with figs inside. It's not a fig Newton. That's not what I have in mind, okay? What I have in mind is the fact that when you compress dates together, so you can do that. I mean, you've seen it in the market, too, the dates that are pressed together. So this is what they refer to when they mean igulei dvela, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, not dates, but figs is what I have in mind, okay? All right. Then, not only that, but the Mishnah said also that the Nofis Tzufim stopped. Right? There's another thing that was came to an end with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Gemara wants to know my Nofis Tzufim. So what's Nofis Tzufim? Okay?
What means?
Yeah, what is Nofis Tzufim? Does anybody remember where we find it in Tilim?
Nofis
Tzufim. Yeah, we say it every Shabbos.
Say it every Shabbos?
Yeah, every Shabbos we say it. In Sukkot and Zimra. The answer is, Alnam Natseich, Mizmodov, Shemaim, Sarpim, Koit Kael, and so on, right?
No, it's Mizmodov.
Yeah, so on, right. And it says over there, Hanechemodim, Mizohov, Mipaz Rav, right?
Yeah,
that they are more precious than the finest gold, right?
Yeah.
Sukk, Midvash, Nofis Tzufim. And they're sweeter than honey and the Nofis Tzufim. So usually the translation of Tzufim is honey out of the honeycomb, which apparently is
even more sweet maybe or something than you know, the kind of honey that comes from a jar. Okay, all right. So this is the translation, but the Gemara was not sure that this is really that this is the meaning of Nofes Sufim. So Omar Rav, Rav says, what is Nofes Sufim? He says it's solus, it's fine flour, right? She sofa al gabe nofa, which floats on the top of the nofa. Nofa is the sieve that they use in order to separate the fine flour, you know, from the ordinary flour, okay? And over it is like a mist, which apparently is, you know, it resembles the honey. And he says, this is, he says, V'dome le'iso sh'neloisha b'dvash v'shemen. And it resembles this